We're armed and probably have trips set up. We know they're killers. Rourke came back to the gathering around the car hood and asked Gearson to wait in one of the bureau cars while he finished up with the investigators. The DWP man walked to the car with his head down, disappointed he was no longer part of the plan. "We're not going in after them," Rourke said after Gearson shut the car door. "Too dangerous. They have weapons, explosives. We have no element of surprise. It adds up to heavy casualties for us. So we trap them. We let things take their course, and then we will be there waiting, safely, when they come out. Then we'll have surprise on our side. Tonight, SWAT will make a recon run through the Wilshire line. We'll get some DWP uniforms from Gearson and look for their entry point. Then we'll set up and wait in whatever's the best location, whatever's safest from our standpoint." There was a beat of silence, punctuated by a horn from the street, before Orozco protested. "Wait a minute, wait a minute." He waited until every face was on his, except Rourke's. He didn't look at Orozco at all. "We can't be talking about sitting out here with our thumbs up our asses and letting these people blast their way into that vault," Orozco said. "To let them go in and pry open a couple hundred boxes and then just back out? My obligation is to protect the property of the citizens of Beverly Hills, who probably happen to constitute 90% of that business's customers. I'm not going along with this." Rourke collapsed his pen pointer, put it in the inside pocket of his coat, and then spoke. He still did not look at Orozco. "Orozco, your exception can be noted for the record, but we're not asking you to go along with this," Rourke said. Bosch noticed that along with failing to address Orozco by his rank, Rourke had dropped all pretense of courtesy. "This is a federal operation," Rourke continued. "You are here as a professional courtesy. Besides, if my thinking is correct, they will open one deposit box only. When they find it empty, they will cancel the operation and leave the vault." Orozco was lost. His face showed it. Bosch could see he obviously had not been given many details of the investigation. He felt sorry for him, hung out to dry by Rourke. "There are things we can't discuss at this point," Rourke said. "But we believe their target is only one box. We have reason to believe it is now empty. When the perps break into the vault and open that particular box and find it is empty, we believe they will back out in a hurry. Our job now is to be ready for that." Bosch wondered about Rourke's supposition. Would the thieves back out? Or would they think they had the wrong box and keep drilling, looking for Tron's diamonds? Or would they loot the other boxes in hope of stealing property valuable enough to make the tunnel caper worth it? Bosch didn't know. He certainly wasn't as sure as Rourke. But then he knew the FBI agent might just be posturing to get Orozco out of the way. "What if they don't back out?" Bosch asked. "What if they keep drilling?" "Then we all have a long weekend ahead of us," Rourke said, "because we are going to wait them out." "Either way, you're going to put that place out of business," Orozco said, pointing in the direction of the stock building. "Once it is known that somebody blew a hole through the vault they've got sitting out there in the big window, there will be no public confidence. Nobody will put their property in there." Rourke just stared at him. The captain's plea was falling on deaf ears. "If you can catch them after they break in, why not before?" Orozco said. "Why don't we open up that place, run a siren, make some noise, even sit a patrol car out front? Do something to let them know we are here and we know about them. That'll scare them out before they break in. We catch them, we save the business. We don't, we still save the business and we get them another day." "Captain," Rourke said, the false congeniality back. "If you let them know we are here, you take away our one advantage, surprise, and invite a firefight in the tunnels and perhaps up on the street in which they will not care who is hurt, who is killed. That's including themselves and perhaps innocent bystanders. Then how do we explain to the public and even ourselves that we did it this way because we wanted to try to save a business?" Rourke waited a beat to let his words sink in, then said, "You see, Captain, I am not going to hedge on safety on this operation. I can't. These men that are down there, they don't scare. They kill. Two people that we know about, including a witness, and that's only this week. No way are we going to let them get away. No fucking way." Orozco leaned across the hood and rolled his blueprint up. As he snapped a rubber band around it, he said, "Gentlemen, don't fuck up. If you do, my department and I will not hold back our criticism or the details of what was discussed at this meeting. Good night." He turned and walked back to the patrol car. The two uniforms followed without being told to. Everybody else just watched. When the patrol car drove down the ramp, Rourke said, "Well, you heard the man. We can't fuck this up. Anybody else want to suggest something?" "What about putting people in the vault now and waiting for them to come up?" Bosch said. He hadn't really considered it, but threw it out as it came to him. "No," the SWAT man said. "You put people in the vault and they're in a corner, no options, no way out. I wouldn't even ask my men for volunteers." "They could be injured by the blast," Rourke added. "No telling where or when the perps will come up." Bosch nodded. They were right.
"Can we open the vault and go in once we know they've come up?"
one of the agents said. Bosch couldn't remember now whether he was Hanlon or Hauk.
"Yes, there's a way to take the door off the time lock,"
Wish said.
"We'd need to get Avery, the owner, back out here."
"From what Avery said, it looks like that would take too long," Bosch said. "Too slow. Avery can take it off time lock and open it, but it's a 2-ton door that swings open on its own weight. At best, it would take a half minute to get it open. Maybe less, but they'd still have a drop on us, the people inside. Same risk as coming at them through the tunnels."
"What about a flashbang?"
one of the agents said. "We open the vault door just a bit and throw in a flash grenade, then we go in and take them." Rourke and the SWAT man shook their head in unison.
"For two reasons," the SWAT man said. "If they wire the tunnel, as we assume they will, the flash could detonate the charges. We could see Wilshire Boulevard out there drop 30 feet, and we don't want that. Think of the paperwork."
When no one smiled, he continued.
"Secondly, that's a glass room we are talking about. Our position in there would be very vulnerable. If they have a lookout, we're dead. We think they go with radio silence when they've got the explosives out, but what if they don't, and this lookout lets them know we're out there? They might be ready to toss something out at us while we're tossing something in."
Rourke added his own thoughts.
"Never mind the lookout. We put a SWAT team in that glass room and they can watch it on TV. We'll have every station in L.A. with a camera out on the sidewalk and traffic backed up to Santa Monica. It'd be a circus. So forget that. SWAT will get with Gearson, do the recon, and get the exits down by the freeway covered. We wait for them underneath and we take them on our terms. That's it."
The SWAT man nodded. And Rourke continued.
"Starting tonight, we'll have 24-hour surveillance topside on the vault. I want Wish, Bosch on the vault side of the building, Hanlon, Hauk on Rincon Street so you can see the door. If it looks or sounds like it is going down, I want to be alerted, and I will alert SWAT to stand by. Use landlines if possible. We don't know if they are monitoring our freaks. You people on the surveillance will have to work out a code to use on the radio. Everybody got that?"
"What if there's an alarm?" Bosch asked. "There have been 3 so far this week."
Rourke thought a moment and said,
"Handle it routinely. Meet the call-out manager, Avery, or whoever at the door, and reset the alarm and send him on his way. I'll get back to Orozco and tell him to send his patrols on the alarms, but we'll handle things."
"Avery will get the call-outs," Wish said. "He already knows what we think is going to happen here. What if he wants to open the vault, take a look around?"
"Don't let him. It's that simple. It's his vault, but his life would be endangered. We can prevent it."
Rourke looked around at the faces. There were no more questions.
"Then that's it. I want people in position in 90 minutes. That gives you all-nighters time to eat, piss, and get coffee. Wish, give me status reports landline at midnight in 0600. Got it?"
"Got it."
Rourke and the SWAT man got in the car where Gearson was waiting and drove down the ramp. Bosch, Wish, Hanlon, and Hauk then worked out a radio code to use. They decided to switch the streets in the surveillance area with the names of streets downtown. The idea was, if anyone was listening to the Simplex 5 public safety frequency, they would think they were hearing reports on a surveillance at Broadway and First Street in downtown, instead of Wilshire and Rincon in Beverly Hills. They also decided to refer to the vault room as a pawn shop while on the radio. That done, the two sets of investigators split up and agreed to check in at the start of the surveillance. As Hanlon and Hauk's car headed toward the ramp, Bosch, alone with Wish for the first time since the plans were set, asked what she thought.
"I don't know. I don't like the idea of letting them go into the vault and then run around loose down there after. I wonder if the SWAT team can really cover everything."
"I guess we'll find out."
A car came up the ramp and drove toward them. The lights blinded Bosch, and for a moment he thought of the car that had come at them the night before. But then the car swerved and came to a stop. It was Hanlon and Hauk. The passenger window was rolled down, and Hauk held a thick manila envelope out the window.
"Mail call, Harry," the agent said. "Forgot we were supposed to give this to you. Somebody from your office dropped it by the bureau today, said you were waiting for it but hadn't been by Wilcox to get it."
Bosch took the envelope and held it out away from his body. Hauk noticed the discomfort on his face.
"The guy's name was Edgar, black guy, said you used to be partners," Hauk said. "Said it had been sitting in your mailbox 2 days, and he thought it might be important. Said he was showing somebody a house out in Westwood and decided to drop it by while he was in the area. That sound legit to you?"
Bosch nodded, and the two agents drove away again. The heavy envelope was sealed, but the return address was the U.S. Armed Services Records Archive in St. Louis. He tore off the end of the envelope and looked inside. There was a thick file of papers.
"What is it?"
Wish asked. "It's Meadows' package. I forgot I ordered it. Did it Monday before I knew you guys were on the case. Anyway, I've already seen this stuff." He tossed the envelope through the open window of the car onto the back seat.
"Hungry?"
she asked him. "I want some coffee, at least."
"I know a place."
Bosch was sipping steaming black coffee from a plastic cup he had taken from the restaurant, an Italian place on Pico, behind Century City. He was in the car, back in place on the second floor of the parking garage across Wilshire from the vault. Wish opened the door and got in after making her midnight check-in call to Rourke.
"They found the Jeep."
"Where?"
"Rourke says SWAT did the reconnaissance ride through the Wilshire storm sewer but found no sign of intruders or a tunnel entry. Looks like Gearson was right. They're tucked in one of the smaller tributary lines. Anyway, the SWAT guys then went down to the drainage wash by the freeway to set the trap. They were deploying at 3 exit positions from the tunnels when they came across the Jeep. Rourke said there's a carpool parking lot down by the freeway. There's a beige Jeep parked with a covered trailer attached. It's theirs. The 3 blue ATVs are in the trailer."
"Is he getting a warrant?"
"Yeah, he's got somebody trying to find a judge now, so they'll have it. But they aren't going to go near it until they take down the operation, in case their plan is for someone to come out and get the ATVs, or somebody already outside is going to show up and drive them in."
Bosch nodded and sipped. It was a smart way to go. He remembered he had a cigarette going in the ashtray and tossed it out the open window. As if guessing what he would be thinking, she said,
"Rourke said that from what they could see there was no blanket in the back of the Jeep. But if it's the Jeep Meadows' body was carried to the reservoir in, there still should be fiber evidence."
"What about the seal that Sharkey saw on the door?"
"Rourke said there was no seal, but there could have been one and they just took it off when they were leaving the Jeep out there."
"Yeah," Bosch said. After a few moments of thought, he said, "Does it bother you how everything is just coming together so well?"
"Should it?"
Bosch shrugged his shoulders. He looked up Wilshire. The curb in front of the fire plug was empty. Since they had come back from dinner, Bosch hadn't seen the white LTD, which he'd been sure was an IAD car. He didn't know if Lewis and Clark were around or had called it a night.
"Harry, good detective work pays off with cases that come together," Eleanor told him. "I mean, we aren't out of the dark on this by a long shot, but I think we finally have a measure of control. Damn sight better than we were 3 days ago, so why the worry when a few things finally start coming together?"
3 days ago, Sharkey was still alive.
"Well, while you're taking the blame for that, why don't you add everybody else who has ever made a choice and gotten themselves killed? You can't change those things, Harry, and you're not supposed to be a martyr."
"What do you mean, choice? Sharkey didn't make any choice."
"Yes, he did. When he chose the streets, he knew he might die on the streets."
"You don't believe that. He was a kid."
"I believe that shit happens. I believe that the best you can do in this job is come out even. Some people win, and some lose. Hopefully, half the time it is the good guys who win. That's us, Harry."
Bosch drank his cup dry, and they sat in silence for a while after that. They had a clear view of the vault sitting at the center of the glass room like a throne. Out there in the open, polished and shiny under the bright ceiling lights, it said, "Take me to the world," he thought. And somebody would. We're going to let them. Wish picked up the radio handset, keyed the transmit button twice, and said,
"Broadway 1 to 1st, do you guys copy?"
"We copy, Broadway. Anything?"
It was Hauk's voice on the comeback. There was a lot of static as the radio waves ricocheted off the tall buildings in the area.
"Only checking. What's your position?"
"We are due south of the front door of the pawn shop. A clear view of nothing going on.
We're east. Can see the...
She clicked off the mic and looked at Bosch.
We forgot a code for the vault. Got any ideas?
Bosch shook his head no, but then said, Saxophone. I've seen saxophones hanging in pawn shop windows. Musical instruments, lots of them. She clicked the mic open again.
Sorry, First Street, had technical difficulty. We are east of the pawn shop, have the piano in the window in sight. No activity inside.
Stay awake.
That's okay, Broadway out.
Bosch smiled and shook his head.
What? She said. What?
I've seen lots of musical instruments in pawn shops, but I don't know about a piano. Who's going to take a piano to a pawn shop? You'd need a truck. We've blown our cover now.
He picked up the radio mic, but without clicking the transmit button, and said,
First Street, check that. It's not a piano in the window. That's an accordion. Our mistake.
She slugged him on the shoulder and told him to never mind the piano. They settled into an easy silence. Surveillance jobs were the bane of most detectives' existence. But in his 15 years on the job, Bosch had never minded a single stakeout. In fact, many times he enjoyed them when he was with good company. He defined good company not by the conversation, but by the lack of it. When there was no need to talk to feel comfortable, that was the right company. Bosch thought about the case and watched the traffic pass by the vault. He recapped the events as they had occurred, in order from start to present, revisiting scenes, listening to the dialogue over again. He found that often this reaccounting helped him make the next choice or step. What he mulled over now, poking at it like a loose tooth with his tongue, was the hit and run, the car that had come at them the night before. Why? What did they know at that point that made them so dangerous? It seemed to be a foolish move to kill a cop and a federal agent. Why was it undertaken? His mind then drifted to the night they had spent together after all the questions were asked by all the supervisors. Eleanor was spooked, more so than he. As he had held her in her bed, he felt as though he were calming a frightened animal, holding and caressing her as she breathed into his neck. They had not made love, just held each other. It had somehow seemed more intimate.
Are you thinking about last night?
She asked then. How did you know?
A guess. Any ideas?
Well, I think it was nice. I think we...
I'm talking about who tried to kill us last night.
Oh. No ideas. I was thinking about the after.
Oh. You know, I didn't thank you, Harry, for being with me like that, not expecting anything.
I should thank you.
You're sweet.
They drifted into their own thoughts again. Leaning against the door with his head against the side window, Bosch rarely took his eyes off the vault. Traffic on Wilshire was light but steady. People heading to or from the clubs over on Santa Monica Boulevard or around Rodeo Drive. There was probably a premiere at nearby Academy Hall. It seemed to Bosch that every limousine in L.A. was working Wilshire this night. Stretch cars of all makes and colors cruised by one. They moved so smoothly they seemed to float. They were beautiful and intriguing with their black windows, like exotic women in sunglasses, a car built just for this city, Bosch thought.
Has Meadows been buried?
The question surprised him. He wondered what tumble of thought led to it.
No, he answered. Monday over at the Veterans Cemetery.
A Memorial Day funeral. Sounds kind of fitting. So his life of crime did not disqualify him from being placed in such sacred ground?
No, he did his time over there in Vietnam. They've saved a space for him. There's probably one there for me, too. Why'd you ask?
I don't know, just thinking is all. Will you go?
If I'm not sitting here watching this vault.
That would be nice of you. I know he meant something to you at one point in your life.
He let it drop, but then she said,
Harry, tell me about the Black Echo. What you said the other day, what did you mean?
For the first time, he looked away from the vault and at Eleanor. Her face was in darkness, but headlights from a passing car lit the interior of the car for a moment, and he could see her eyes on his. He looked back at the vault.
There really isn't anything to tell. It's just what we called one of the intangibles.
Intangibles?
There was no name for it, so he made up a name. It was the darkness, the damp emptiness you'd feel when you were down there alone in those tunnels. It was like you were in a place where you felt dead and buried in the dark, but you were alive. And you were scared. Your own breath kind of echoed in the darkness, loud enough to give you away, or so you thought. I don't know, it's hard to explain, just the black echo.
She let some time slide between them before she said, I think your going to the funeral is nice.
Is something wrong?
What do you mean?
What I said. The way you're talking. You haven't seemed right since last night, like something... I don't know, forget it.
I don't know either, Harry. You know, after the adrenaline wore off, I guess I kind of just got scared. Made me start thinking about things.
Bosch nodded his head, but didn't say anything. His mind drifted, and he remembered a time in the Triangle when a company that had taken heavy casualties from sniper fire stumbled onto the entrance to a tunnel complex. Bosch, Meadows, and a couple of other rats named Jarvis and Hanrahan were dropped at a nearby LZ and escorted to the hole. The first thing they did was drop a couple of LZ flares, a blue one and a red one, into the hole and blow the smoke in with a Mighty Might fan to find the other entrances in the jungle. Pretty soon, ribbons of smoke started curling out of the ground at a couple dozen spots for 200 yards in all directions. The smoke was coming up through the spider holes the snipers used as firing positions, or to move in and out of the tunnels. There were so many of them, the jungle was turning purple from the smoke. Meadows was stoned. He popped a cassette into the portable tape player he always carried and started blasting Hendrix's Purple Haze into the tunnel. It was one of Bosch's most vivid memories, aside from his dreams of the war. He never liked rock and roll after that. The jolting energy of the music reminded him too much of the war.
Did you ever go see the memorial?
Eleanor asked. She didn't have to say which one. There was only the one, in Washington. But then he remembered the long, black replica he had watched them installing at the cemetery by the federal building.
Nah, he said after a while. Never seen it.
After the air in the jungle cleared and the Hendrix tape was done, the four of them had gone into the tunnel while the rest of the company sat on backpacks and chowed and waited. An hour later, only Bosch and Meadows had come back. Meadows carried with him three NVA scouts. He held them up for the troops above ground and yelled,
"You're looking at the baddest blood brother in the Black Echo!"
And so came the name. Later, they found Jarvis and Hanrahan in the tunnels. They had fallen into punji traps. They were dead.
Eleanor said, I visited it when I was living in D.C. I couldn't make myself go to the dedication in 82, but a lot of years later I finally got the courage. I wanted to see my brother's name. I thought maybe it would help me sort things out. You know, about what happened with him.
And did it?
No. Made it worse. Made me angry. It left me with this need for justice, if that makes sense. I wanted justice for my brother.
The silence filled the car again, and Bosch poured more coffee into his cup. He was beginning to feel the onset of caffeine jitters, but couldn't stop. He was addicted. He watched a couple of drunks who were stumbling down the street stop in front of the window before the vault. One of the men threw his hands up as if he was trying to gain a measure of the vault's huge door. After a while, they moved on. He thought of the rage Eleanor must have felt because of her brother, the helplessness. He thought of his own rage. He knew the same feelings, maybe not to the same degree, but from a different perspective. Anybody who was touched by the war knew some part of those feelings. He had never worked it out completely and wasn't sure he wanted to. The anger and sadness gave him something that was better than complete emptiness.
Is that what Meadows felt? He wondered. The emptiness?
Is that what bounced him from job to job and needle to needle until he was finally and fatally used up on his last mission? Bosch decided that he would go to Meadows' funeral, that he owed him that much.
You know what you were telling me the other day about that guy, the dollmaker killer?
Eleanor said.
What about it?
IAD, they tried to make a case that you executed him?
Yes, I told you they tried. But it wasn't there. All they got me on was suspension for procedure violations.
Well, I just wanted to say that even if they were right, they were wrong. That would have been justice in my book. You knew what would happen with a guy like that. Look at the Night Stalker. He'll never get the gas, or it'll take 20 years.
Bosch felt uncomfortable. He had only thought of his motives and actions in the Dollmaker case when alone. He never spoke aloud about it. He didn't know where she was going with this. She said,
I know if it was true, you could never admit it, but I think you either consciously or subconsciously made a decision. You went for justice for all those women, his victims, maybe even for your mother.
Shocked, Bosch turned to her and was about to ask how she knew about his mother and how she had come to think of her relation to the Dollmaker. Then he remembered the files again. It was probably in there somewhere. When he had applied to the department, he had to say on the forms if he or any close relatives had ever been the victim of a crime. He had been orphaned at 11, he wrote, when his mother was found strangled in an alley off Hollywood Boulevard. He didn't need to write what she did for a living. The location and crime said enough. When he recovered his cool, Bosch asked Eleanor what her point was.
No point, she said. I just respect that. If it were me, I would have liked to have done the same thing, I think. I hope I would have been brave enough.
He looked over at her, the darkness shielding both their faces. It was late now, and no car lights drifted by to show them to each other. You go ahead and take the first shift sleeping, he said. I drank too much coffee. She didn't answer. He offered to get out a blanket he had put in the trunk, but she declined.
Did you ever hear what J. Edgar Hoover said about justice? She asked.
He probably said a lot, but I don't recall any of it offhand.
He said that justice is incidental to law and order. I think he was right.
She said nothing else, and after a while he could hear her breathing turn deeper and longer. When the rare car drove by, he would look over at her face as the light washed across it. She slept like a child, with her head leaning against her hands. Bosch cracked the window and lit a cigarette. He smoked and wondered if he could or would fall in love with her, and she with him. He was thrilled and disquieted by the thought, all at the same time. Part 7, Saturday, May 26th. Gray dawn came up over the street and filled the car with weak light. The morning also brought with it a gentle drizzle that wet the street and put a smear of condensation on the lower half of the windows of Beverly Hills Safe and Lock. It was the first rain of any kind in months that Bosch could remember. Wish slept, and he watched the vault. Overhead lights still glowed on the chrome and brushed steel finish. It was past 6 o'clock, but Bosch had forgotten the check-in call to Rourke and let Eleanor sleep. In fact, during the night he had never wakened her so that he could take a turn sleeping. He just never got tired. Hauk checked in on the radio at 3:30 to make sure someone was awake. After that, there were no disturbances and no activity in the vault room. For the rest of the night, Bosch thought alternately of Eleanor Wish and the vault he watched. He reached for the cup on the dashboard and checked for even a cold gulp of coffee, but it was empty. He dropped the empty over the seat to the floor. As he did this, he noticed the package from St. Louis on the back seat. He reached back and grabbed the manila envelope. He pulled out the thick sheaf of papers and idly looked through them while glancing up at the vault every few seconds. Most of Meadows' military records he had already seen. But he quickly noticed that there were several that had not been in the FBI jacket Wish had given him. This was a more complete record. There was a photostat of his draft report notice and medical exam. There were also medical records from Saigon. He had been treated twice for syphilis, once for acute stress reaction. Paging through the package, he stopped when his eyes fell on a copy of a 2-page letter from a Louisiana congressman named Noon. Curious, Bosch began to read. It was dated 1973 and was addressed to Meadows at the embassy in Saigon. The letter, bearing the official congressional seal, thanked Meadows for his hospitality and help during the congressman's recent fact-finding visit. Noon noted that it had been a pleasant surprise to find a fellow New Iberian in the strange country. Bosch wondered how much of a coincidence it had been. Meadows had probably been assigned as security for the congressman, so they would hit it off, and the legislator would go back to Washington with a high opinion of personnel and morale in Southeast Asia. There are no coincidences. The second page of the letter congratulated Meadows on a fine career and referred to the good reports Noon had received from Meadows' commanding officer. Bosch read on. Meadows' involvement in stopping an illegal entry into the embassy hotel during the congressman's stay was mentioned, and Lieutenant Rourke had furnished details of Meadows' heroics to the congressman's staff. Bosch felt a trembling below his heart, as if the blood was draining from it. The letter finished with some small talk about the home parish. There was the large, flowing signature of the congressman and a typed notation in the bottom left margin. Carbon copy, U.S. Army Records Division, Washington, D.C., Lieutenant John H. Rourke, U.S. Embassy, Saigon, Vietnam. The Daily Iberian, Attention News Editor. Bosch stared at the second page for a long time without moving or breathing. He actually thought he felt the beginning sensation of nausea and wiped his hand across his forehead. He tried to think if he had ever heard Rourke's middle name or initial. He couldn't remember. But it didn't matter. There was no doubt. No coincidences. Eleanor's pager sounded, startling them both like a shot. She sat forward and began fumbling with her purse until she found the pager and shut off the noise.
Oh, God, what time is it?
She said, still disoriented. He said it was 6:20, and only then remembered that they were supposed to have checked in with Rourke on a landline 20 minutes earlier. He slid the letter back into the stack of papers and put them back in the envelope. He threw it back on the back seat.
Ugh, I've got to call in,
Wish said. Hey, take a couple of minutes to wake up, Bosch replied quickly. I'll call in. I gotta find a restroom anyway, and I'll get some coffee and water. He opened the door and stepped out before she could protest the plan. She said,
Harry, why did you let me sleep?
I don't know. What's his number?
I should call him.
Give me the number. She gave it to him, and Bosch walked around the corner and a short distance to the 24-hour diner called Darling's. He was in a daze the whole way, ignoring the panhandlers who had come out with the sun, trying to fathom that it was Rourke who was the inside man. What was he doing? There was a part of this that was missing, and Bosch couldn't figure it. If Rourke was the insider, then why would he allow them to set up surveillance on the vault? Did he want his people caught? He saw the payphones out front of the restaurant.
You're late,
Rourke said after picking up on half a ring. We forgot.
Bosch? Where's Wish? She's supposed to make the call.
Don't worry about it, Rourke. She's watching the vault like she's supposed to. What are you doing?
I've been waiting to hear from you people before I headed in. Did you two fall asleep or what? What's happening there?
Nothing is happening. But you already know that, don't you? There was a silence during which an old panhandler walked up to the booth and asked Bosch for money. Bosch put his hand on the man's chest and firmly pushed him away.
You still there, Rourke?
He said into the phone.
What was that supposed to mean? How do I know what's going on there when you people don't call in like you're supposed to? And you, with the veiled references all the time. Bosch, I don't get you.
Let me ask you something. Did you really put people down at the tunnel exits? Or was that blueprint and your pointer and the SWAT guy all for show?
Put Wish on the line. I don't know what you're saying.
Sorry, she can't come to the phone at the moment.
Bosch, I'm calling you in. Something is wrong. You've been out all night on this. I think you should... No, I'll get a couple of fresh people out there. I'm going to have to call your lieutenant and...
You knew Meadows.
What?
What I said. You knew him. I have his file, man. His complete file. Not the edited version you gave Wish to give me. You were his CO at the embassy in Saigon. I know. More silence, then.
I was CO to a lot of people, Bosch. I didn't know them all.
Bosch shook his head. That's weak, Lieutenant Rourke. Really weak. That was worse than just admitting it. I'll tell you what. I'll see you around. Bosch hung up the phone and went into Darling's, where he ordered two coffees and two mineral waters. He stood by the cash register, waiting for the girl to put the order together and looking out the window. He was thinking only of Rourke. The girl came up to the cash register with the order in a cardboard carry-out box. He paid and tipped her and went back out to the payphone. Bosch called Rourke's number again with no plan other than to see if he was on the phone or had left. He hung up after 10 rings. Then he called the LAPD dispatch center and told an operator to call FBI dispatch and ask if they had a SWAT call-out working in the Wilshire area in or near Beverly Hills, and if they needed any help. While he waited, he tried to put his mind inside Rourke's caper. He opened up one of the coffees and sipped it. The dispatcher came back on the line with a confirmation that FBI did have a SWAT surveillance in the Wilshire district. No backup was requested. Bosch thanked her and hung up. Now he thought he knew what Rourke was doing. It had to be that there were no men about to break into the vault. The setup on the vault was just that, a setup. The vault was a decoy. Bosch thought about how he had let Tran go his way after following him to the vault. What he had done was flush the second captain out with his diamonds so Rourke could have at him. Bosch had simply played into his hands. When Bosch got back to the car, he saw that Eleanor was looking through Meadows' files. She hadn't gotten to the congressman's letter yet.
"Where have you been?"
she said good-naturedly. Rourke had a lot of questions. He took the Meadows file out of her hands and said, "There's something I wanted you to see here. Where did you get the file on Meadows that you showed me?"
"I don't know. Rourke got it. Why?"
He found the letter and handed it to her without saying anything.
"What is this? 1973?
"Read it. This is Meadows' file, the one I had copied and sent from St. Louis. There is no letter like this one in the file Rourke gave you to give me. He sanitized it. Read. You'll see why." He glanced over at the vault door. Nothing was happening, and he didn't expect anything to be. Then he watched her as she read. She raised an eyebrow as she scanned both pages, not seeing the name.
"Yes, so he was some kind of a hero," it says. "I don't..."
Her eyes widened as she got to the bottom.
"Copied to Lieutenant John Rourke?"
"Uh-huh. You also missed the first reference." He pointed to the sentence that named Rourke as Meadows' CO. "The inside man. What do you think we should do?"
"I don't know. Are you sure? This doesn't prove anything."
If it was a coincidence, he should have said he knew the guy, cleared it up. Like me, I came in. He didn't because he didn't want the connection known. I called him on it when we were on the phone. He lied. He didn't know we had this.
Now he knows you know?
Yeah. I don't know what he thinks I know. I hung up on him. The question is, what do we do about it? We're probably spinning our wheels here. The whole thing's a charade. Nobody's going into that vault. They probably took Tran down after he checked his diamonds out and left. We led him right to slaughter. Then he realized that maybe the white LTD belonged to the robbers, not Lewis and Clark. They had followed Bosch and Wish to Tran.
"Wait a minute," Eleanor said. "I don't know. What about the alarms all week, the fire hydrant and the arson? It has to be happening like we thought."
"I don't know. Nothing's making sense right now. Maybe Rourke is leading his people into a trap. Or a slaughter." They both stared ahead at the vault. The rain had slacked off. The sun was completely up now, and it set the steel door aglow. Eleanor finally spoke.
"I think we have to get some help. We have Hanlon and Houck sitting on the other side of the bank, and SWAT, unless that was part of Rourke's charade."
Bosch told her he had checked on the SWAT surveillance and learned that it actually was in place.
"Then what is Rourke doing?" she said.
"Pushing all the buttons." They kicked it around for a few minutes and decided to call Orozco at Beverly Hills Police. First, Eleanor checked in with Hanlon and Houck. Bosch wanted to keep them in place.
"You guys awake over there?"
she said into the Motorola.
"That's 10-4, barely. I feel like that guy stuck in his car in the overpass after the earthquake up in Oakland." What's up?
Anything? No, just checking. How's the front door?
Not a knock all night.
She signed off, and there was a moment of silence before Bosch turned to get out of the car to call Orozco. He stopped and looked back at her. You know, he died, he said.
Who died?
The guy that was in that overpass. Just then there was a thump that slightly shook the car. Not as much a sound as a vibration, an impact, not unlike the first jolt of an earthquake. There was no following vibration. But after 1 or 2 seconds, an alarm sounded. The ringing came loud and clear from the Beverly Hills Safe and Lock Company. Bosch sat bolt upright, staring into the vault room. There was no visible sign of intrusion. Almost immediately, the radio crackled with Hanlon's voice.
We got a bell. What's our plan of action?
Neither Bosch nor Wish answered the radio call at first. They just sat staring at the vault, dumbfounded. Rourke had let his people walk right into a trap, or so it seemed.
Son of a bitch, Bosch said. They're in.
Bosch said, tell Hanlon and Hauk to stay cool until we get orders.
And who is going to give the orders?
Eleanor asked. Bosch didn't answer. He was thinking of what was going on in the vault. Why would Rourke lead his people into a setup? He must not have been able to warn them. Tell them that the diamonds aren't there and that we're up here, he said. I mean, 24 hours ago, we didn't know about this place or what was going on. Maybe by the time we got onto it, it was too late. They were too far in.
So they're just proceeding as planned, Eleanor said.
They'll pop Tran's box first, if they've done their homework and know which one it is. They'll find it empty, and then what do? Split, or open more boxes until they get enough stuff to make the whole thing worth their while.
I think they split, she answered. I think when they open Tran's box and find no diamonds, they figure something is going down and get the hell out of there.
Then we won't have much time. My guess is they'll get stuff ready in the vault, but they won't actually drill the box until after we've reset the alarm and cleared the scene. We can delay the resetting a bit, but too long and they might get suspicious and clear out, looking and ready for our people in the tunnels. He got out of the car and looked back at Eleanor. Get on the radio. Tell those guys to stay put, then get a message to your SWAT people. Tell them we think we've got people in the vault.
They'll want to know why Rourke isn't telling them.
Think of something. Tell them you don't know where Rourke is.
Where are you going?
To meet the patrol call out for the alarm. I'll have them call Orozco out here. He slammed the door shut and walked down the garage ramp. Eleanor made the radio calls. As Bosch approached Beverly Hills Safe and Lock, he took his badge wallet out, folded it backward, and hooked it in the breast pocket of his coat. He turned the corner around the glass vault room and jogged to the front steps just as a Beverly Hills patrol car pulled up, lights flashing but no siren. Two patrolmen got out, sliding their sticks out of the PVC pipe holders on the doors and then into the rings on their belts. Bosch introduced himself, told them what he was doing, and asked them to get a message through to Captain Orozco as soon as possible. One of the cops said the manager, a guy named Avery, was being called out to reset the alarm while the cops checked the place out. All routine. They said they were getting to know the guy. It was the third alarm they had been called to here this week. They also said they already had orders to report any calls to this address to Orozco at his home, no matter the hour.
You mean these call-outs, they weren't false alarms? Said the one named Onaga.
We aren't sure, Bosch said, but we want to handle this like it is a false alarm. The manager gets called out and together you reset the alarm and everybody goes on their way, okay? Just nice and relaxed, nothing unusual.
Good enough,
said the other cop. The copper plate over his pocket said, Johnstone. Holding his nightstick in place on his belt, he trotted back to their cruiser to make the call to Orozco.
Here's our Mr. Avery now, Onaga said.
A white Cadillac floated to a stop at the curb behind the Beverly Hills car. Avery III, who was wearing a pink sports shirt and Madras slacks, got out and walked up. He recognized Bosch and greeted him by name.
Has there been a break-in?
Mr. Avery, we think something might be going on here. We don't know. We need time to check it out. What we want for you to do is open up the office, take a walk around like you usually do, like you did when the alarms went off earlier this week. then reset the alarm and lock up again.
That's it.
What if, Mr. Avery, what we want you to do is get in your car and drive away like you usually do, like you're going home, but I want you to go around the corner to Darling's. Go in and have a coffee. I'll either come by to tell you what is happening or send for you. I want you to relax. We can handle whatever comes up here. We have other people checking it out, but for the sake of appearances, we want to make it seem that we are passing this off as another false alarm.
I see, Avery said, digging a key ring from his pocket.
He walked to the front door and opened it. And by the way, that is not the vault alarm that is ringing. It is the exterior alarm, set off by vibrations on the windows of the vault room. I can tell. It's a different tone, you see.
Bosch figured the tunnelers had disabled the vault alarm system, not realizing the exterior alarm was a separate system. Onaga and Avery went in, with Bosch trailing behind. As Harry stood in the entryway looking for smoke and not seeing any, sniffing for cordite but not smelling any, Johnstone came in.
Bosch put his hands to his lips to warn the officer against yelling above the sound of the alarm. Johnstone nodded, cupped his hand to Bosch's ear, and told him that Orozco would be there in 20 minutes, tops. He lived up in the valley. Bosch nodded and hoped it would be soon enough. The alarm shut off, and Avery and Onaga came out of Avery's office into the lobby, where Johnstone and Bosch waited. Onaga looked at Bosch and shook his head, indicating nothing amiss.
"Do you usually check the vault room?" Bosch asked.
"We just look around," Avery said.
He proceeded to the X-ray machine, switched it on, and explained it took 50 seconds to warm up. They passed the time without talking. Finally, Avery put his hand on the reader. It read it and approved the bone structure, and the lock on the first door of the man-trap snapped open.
"Since I don't have my man inside the vault room, I have to override the lock on the second door," Avery said. "Gentlemen, if you don't mind not looking once we are in."
The four of them moved into the tiny man-trap, and Avery pushed a set of numbers on the combination lock on the second door. It snapped open, and they moved into the vault room. There was nothing to see but steel and glass. Bosch stood near the vault door and listened, but heard nothing. He walked to the glass wall and looked up Wilshire. He could see that Eleanor was back in the car on the second floor of the garage. He turned his attention to Avery, who walked up to his side as if to look out the window himself, but instead huddled into a conspiratorial posture.
"Remember, I can open the vault," he said in a low whisper.
Bosch looked at him and shook his head, then said, "No, I don't want to do that. Too dangerous. Let's get out of here." Avery had a perplexed look on his face, but Bosch walked away. 5 minutes later, Beverly Hills' safe and lock was cleared and locked down. The two cops went back out on patrol, and Avery left. Bosch walked back to the garage. The street was busier now, and the noise of the day had begun. The garage was filling with cars and the stink of exhaust. Inside the car, Wish told him that Hanlon, Hauk, and Swat were in holding positions. He told her Orozco was on the way. Bosch wondered how long it would take before the men in the tunnel believed it was safe to start drilling. Orozco was still 10 minutes away. It was a long time.
"So what do we do when he gets here?" she said.
"His town, his call," he said. "We just lay it out for him and do whatever he wants to do. We tell him we have one fucked-up operation going here, and we don't know who to trust. Not the guy in charge of it, at least."
They sat in silence for a minute or two after that. Bosch smoked a cigarette, and Eleanor didn't say anything about it. She seemed lost in her own thoughts, a puzzled look on her face. They both nervously checked their watches every 30 seconds or so. Lewis waited until the white Cadillac he tailed had turned north off Wilshire. As soon as the car was out of sight of Beverly Hills Safe and Lock, Lewis picked the blue emergency light up off the floor and put it on the dashboard. He flicked it on, but the driver of the Cadillac was already pulling to the side of the road in front of Darling's. Lewis got out of his car and walked up to the caddy. He was met halfway by Avery.
"What is going on, officer?"
Avery said.
"Detective," Lewis said, and he opened his badge wallet.
"Internal Affairs, LAPD. I need to ask you a few questions, sir. We are conducting an investigation of the man,
Detective Harry Bosch, who you were just speaking with at Beverly Hills Safe and Lock.
What do you mean, we?
I left my partner on Wilshire so he can keep an eye on your business, but what I would like is for you to step into my car so we can talk for a few minutes. Something is going on, and I need to know what.
That Detective Bosch... Hey, how do I know you are for real?
How do you know he is? The thing is, we have had Detective Bosch under surveillance for a week, sir, and we know he is engaged in activities that could be, if not illegal, embarrassing to the department. We aren't sure what at this juncture. That's why we need you, sir. Would you step into the car, please?
Avery took two tentative steps toward the IAD car and then seemed to decide, what the heck? He moved quickly to the passenger side and got in. Avery identified himself as the owner of Beverly Hills Safe and Lock and briefly told Lewis what had been said during his two encounters with Bosch and Wish. Lewis listened without commenting, then opened the car door.
Wait here, please. I'll be right back.
Lewis walked briskly up to Wilshire. He stood on the corner a few moments, apparently looking for someone, then made an elaborate show of checking his watch. He came back to the car and slid in behind the wheel. On Wilshire, Clark was waiting in the alcove of a store entrance and watching the vault. He caught sight of Lewis's signal and strolled casually to the car. As Clark climbed into the back seat, Lewis said,
"Mr. Avery here says that Bosch told him to go to Darling's and wait, said there may be people in the vault, come up from underground."
"Did Bosch say what he would be doing?" Clark asked.
"Not a word," Avery said.
Everyone was silent, thinking. Lewis couldn't figure it. If Bosch was dirty, what was he doing? He thought some more on this and realized that if Bosch was involved in ripping off the vault, he was in a perfect situation by being the man calling the shots on the outside. He could confuse the coverage on the burglary. He could send all the manpower to the wrong place while his people in the vault went safely the opposite way.
"He's got everybody by the short hairs," Lewis said,
more to himself than to the other two men in the car.
"Who, Bosch?"
Clark asked.
"He's running the caper. Nothing we can do but watch. We can't get in that vault. We can't go underground without knowing where we are going. He's already got the Bureau's SWAT team tied up down by the freeway. They're waiting for burglars that aren't coming, goddammit."
"Wait a minute, wait a minute," Avery said. "The vault. You can get in it."
Lewis turned fully around in his seat to look at Avery. The vault owner told them that federal banking regulations didn't apply to Beverly Hills Safe and Lock because it wasn't a bank, and how he had the computer code that would open the vault.
"Did you tell this to Bosch?" Lewis asked.
"Yesterday and today."
"Did he already know?"
"No, he seemed surprised. He asked detailed questions on how long it would take to open the vault, what I had to do, things like that. Then today, when we had the alarm, I asked him if we should open it. He said no, just said to get out of there."
"Damn," Lewis said excitedly.
"I better call Irving."
He leapt from the car and trotted to the payphones in front of Darling's. He dialed Irving at home and got no answer. He dialed the office and only got the duty officer. He had the officer page Irving with the payphone number. He then waited for 5 minutes, pacing in front of the phone and worrying about the time going by. The phone never rang. He used the one next to it to call the duty officer back to make sure Irving had been paged. He had. Lewis decided he couldn't wait. He would have to make this call himself, and it would be he who would become the hero. He left the bank of phones and went back to the car.
"What did he say?"
Clark asked.
"We go in," Lewis said.
He started the car. The police radio keyed twice, and then Hanlon's voice came on.
"Hey, Broadway, we have visitors over here on First."
Bosch grabbed up the radio.
"What have you got, First? Nothing showing on Broadway."
"We've got three white males going in on our side, using a key. Looks like one is the man that was here earlier with you. Old guy, plaid pants."
Avery. Bosch held the microphone up to his mouth and hesitated, not sure what to say.
"Now what?"
he said to Eleanor. Like Bosch, she was staring down the street at the vault room, but there was no sign of the visitors. She said nothing.
First, Bosch said into the mic.
Did you see any vehicle?
None seen. They just walked out of the alley on our side. Must have parked there. Want us to take a look?
No. Hold there a minute.
They're now inside. No longer in visual contact. Advise, please.
He turned to Wish and raised his eyebrows.
Who could it be? Ask for descriptions of the two with Avery, she said.
He did.
White males, number one and two in suits, worn and wrinkled. White shirts, both early 30s. One with red hair, stocky build, 5'8", 180. The other, dark brown hair, thinner. I don't know, I'd say these guys were cops.
Heckle and Jekyll? Eleanor said.
Lewis and Clark, it's gotta be them.
What are they doing in there?
Bosch didn't know. Wish took the radio from him.
First?
The radio clicked.
Reason to believe the two subjects in suits are Los Angeles police officers. Stand by.
There they are, Bosch said,
as three figures moved into the glare in the vault room. He opened the glove compartment and grabbed a pair of binoculars.
What are they doing?
Wish asked as he focused. Avery's at the keypad next to the vault.
I think he's opening the damn thing.
Through the binoculars, Bosch saw Avery step away from the computer board and move to the chrome wheel on the vault door. He saw Lewis turn slightly and glance up the street in the direction of the parking garage. Was there a slight trace of a smile there? Bosch thought he saw it. Then, through the binoculars, he saw Lewis draw his weapon from an underarm holster. Clark did likewise, and Avery started turning the wheel, the captain steering the Titanic.
Those dumb assholes, they are opening it!
Bosch leapt out of the car and started running down the ramp. He unholstered his gun and held it up as he ran. He glanced along Wilshire and saw an opening in the sporadic traffic. He bounded across the street, Wish just a short distance behind him. Bosch was still 25 yards away and knew he would be too late. Avery had stopped turning the vault wheel, and Bosch could see him pull back with all his weight. The door began slowly to move open. Bosch heard Eleanor's voice behind him.
No! She yelled. Avery, no!
But Bosch knew the double glass made the vault room silent. Avery couldn't hear her, and Lewis and Clark wouldn't have stopped what they were doing even if they could hear. What happened was like a movie to Bosch. An old movie on a TV set with the sound turned down. The slowly opening vault door with its widening band of blackness inside gave the picture an ethereal, almost underwater quality, a slow-motion inevitability. Bosch felt as if he were on a moving sidewalk going the wrong way, running but getting no closer. He kept his eyes on the vault door, the black margin opening wider. Then Lewis's body moved into Bosch's line of sight and toward the opening vault. Almost immediately, propelled by some unseen force, Lewis jerked backward. His hands flew up and his gun hit the ceiling and then fell soundlessly to the floor. As he backpedaled from the vault, his back and head ripped open and blood and brain spattered the glass wall behind him. As Lewis was hurled away from the vault door, Bosch could see the muzzle flash from the darkness inside, and then spider webs of cracks crazed the double glass as bullets struck silently. Lewis backstepped into a panel of the weakened glass and crashed through onto the sidewalk 3 feet below. The vault was half open now, and the shooter had freer range. The barrage of machine gun fire turned toward Clark, who stood unprotected, his mouth open in shock. Bosch could hear the shots now. He saw Clark attempt to jump away from the line of fire, but it wasn't worth the effort. He, too, was thrown backward by the force of bullets impacting. His body slammed into Avery, and both men fell to the polished marble floor in a heap. The gunfire from the vault ended. Bosch jumped through the opening where the wall of glass had been and slid on his chest across the marble and glass dust. In the same instant, he looked into the vault and saw the blur of a man dropping through the floor. The movement made a swirl in the concrete dust and smoke that hung inside the vault. Like a magician, the man just disappeared in the mist. Then, from the darkness farther inside, a second man moved into the view, framed by the doorway. He sidestepped to the hole, swinging an M16 assault rifle in a covering side-to-side sweep. Bosch recognized him as Art Franklin, one of the Charlie Company graduates. When the black hole of the M16 came his way, Bosch leveled his gun with both hands, wrists on the cold floor, and fired. Franklin fired at the same time. His shots went high, and Bosch heard more glass shattering behind him. Bosch fired two more rounds into the vault. He heard one ping off the steel door. The other caught Franklin in the upper right chest, knocking him to the floor on his back. But in one quick motion, the injured man rolled and went head first.